And a happy birthday today to Lupe Dionda of Mason City and to Juanita Wood of Lone Tree. You are sharing the birthday today, Lupe and Juanita, with some very famous people. Actor Michael Caine and musician Quincy Jones both turned 91 today. And Billy Crystal, the actor, turned 76. A happy birthday to everyone. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. And now here with today's obituaries is Linda.
From Waterloo, Wilma Ann Thornton Johnson, 90, a resident of Friendship Village Wellspring Living in Waterloo, passed away on Tuesday, March 5th, while under the care of Cedar Valley Hospice. A funeral service will be held on March 18th at 10:30 a.m. at the Central Christian Church in Waterloo, with a visitation 1 hour prior at the church. Burial will follow services at the Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Northeast Iowa Food Bank or to the church. Locke at Tower Park is assisting the family, and you can visit their website, lockfuneralservices.com, to offer condolences and watch the live stream of the funeral. From Des Moines, Geraldine Alice Howe, 97, passed away March 4th. She was born June 6, 1926, to Leroy and Nellie Murrow. Family will greet friends Friday, March 15th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens on Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines. Memorial service will take place the following day at 11 a.m., also at the funeral home. For a full obituary or to leave a condolence, you can visit hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. From Des Moines, Mary Ann Barakat, 73, died March 10th at Bishop Drum Care Facility. She was born July 30th, 1950, to Edward Samuel and Mary Lee Nee Newhart Barakat in Omaha, Nebraska. She spent her childhood in Des Moines and Burlington, Iowa. She graduated from Burlington High School, class of 1968. She attended the University of Iowa and was a lifelong Hawkeye fan. She was also a lifelong Cubs fan. She retired from American Republic Insurance Company in Des Moines. Cremation rites have been accorded, and a celebration of her life will be held at 10 a.m. March 15th at the Merlehay Funeral Home. The visitation will be half an hour before the service. She is survived by several cousins. She was preceded in death by her parents. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to an education fund for Carrie Anna and Madison Peterson. Checks can be made out to Ameriprise Financial, or in honor of Mary Ann, to the American Diabetes Association.
And returning now to the news, we have a story on how Iowa's four U.S. House members voted on the TikTok ban. All four Iowa House members in the U.S. House voted in favor of a bill that could result in TikTok being banned from app stores. The U.S. House passed a bill that presented an ultimatum for the popular social media company to either part ways with its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, or be banned from app stores in the United States. The potential ban for TikTok passed the House with a 352-65 vote. Of the opposition, 15 Republicans voted no, along with 50 Democrats. Iowa's delegation, Republican Representative Zach Nunn, Marionette Miller-Meeks, Ashley Henson, and Randy Feenstra voted in favor of the bill. So what did Representative Ashley Hinson say on the Tech Talk bill? Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican who represents Northeast Iowa, co-led the legislation to force the split between TikTok and ByteDance. TikTok is targeting young girls with eating disorder videos and pushing content that downplays terrorism on TikTok in the U.S., Hinson said in a tweet. Hinson compared TikTok to a Chinese spy balloon in people's phones and is beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. Hinson also spoke on the House floor about why TikTok should part ways with the Chinese company. She said, "Today we are sending a message to the CCP that we are going to deflate the 140 million spy balloons they have installed on American phones." Hinson said that Wednesday before the vote. Representative Randy Feenstra say about the TikTok bill? "The bill will protect national security by preventing China from accessing American data," Representative Randy Feenstra, a Republican representing Northwest Iowa, said in a news release supporting the bill. "As a father of four, I believe that TikTok is a serious threat to our national security, our economy, and the well-being of our kids," Feenstra said in a news release. He went on to say, "We know that TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, is largely controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, which directly exposes Americans to Chinese data collection, surveillance, cyber attacks, and propaganda." That's the end of the quote from Mr. Feenstra. Zach Nunn, representative from Southwest Iowa, had this to say. "While in the United States Air Force, U.S. Representative Zach Nunn, who serves the Des Moines area, served as an airborne intelligence officer. Nunn expressed his concern for the impacts of TikTok on younger users. As a former counterintelligence officer, I've seen firsthand how the Chinese Communist Party exploits data to manipulate our country's young people," Nunn said. "Today, I voted to enhance our national security by limiting China's influence on our youth and American minds," he added. What has Representative Marionette Miller Meeks said about the TikTok ban? "The bill targets business conduct, not users, and is aimed to encourage the sale of TikTok in hopes to protect data from foreign adversaries," Representative Marionette Miller Meeks said in a video on social media. "We understand the implication for entertainment and even more importantly for our small business owners in Iowa who use the app in order to advertise and reach out to our consumers," Miller Meeks said. This says costumers. I'm sure that means consumers, Miller Meeks said, who represents Iowa City and Eastern Iowa. She said that in her video posted on social media. She went on to say, "So we are trying to protect people's privacy and also their content and address a national security issue. So what happens next with the proposed TikTok ban? The future of the bill in the Senate is unclear. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, has not said whether he will bring it up for a vote. President Joe Biden said he would sign the legislation if it made it to his desk. Even if the Senate passes the bill, TikTok would have just shy of 6 months to sell the app before a ban from app stores and web hosting services would start. So it's in the Senate, so what do our senators have to say about TikTok? This is what Joni Ernst said about banning TikTok. After the House voted Wednesday, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst posted on social media saying that cutting ties between TikTok and the Chinese Communist Party is overdue. "Allowing them to operate under China's authority threatens the security of every American," Ernst said in a tweet. And finally, what has Senator Chuck Grassley said about banning TikTok? U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley told Iowa reporters Wednesday that he thinks Schumer should bring the legislation up for a vote in the Senate and that he is leaning towards voting it, using his words. "I am getting closer to say a firm yes to vote for it," Grassley said. But he still hopes to have conversations with people in the intelligence community as well as fellow senators who serve on the Intelligence Committee before making a final decision. "The majority problem is that I think anything that's connected to the Chinese Communist Party must be suspect, and that's why I'm telling you I'm leaning towards it," Grassley said. "But I'm going to reserve just a little bit of judgment till I get briefings that we ought to have before we pass it," he added. Grassley said the federal phone senators use Grassley said that the federal phones senators use prevent them from accessing TikTok, and he has never personally used the app. Grassley is active on other social media platforms like X, formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram.
Trump edges Biden as economy brightens. The USA Today's Suffolk poll shows fluid electorate. Donald Trump edged President Joe Biden 40% to 38% in an exclusive USA Today Suffolk University poll, a near tie in a fluid electorate as the candidates head out of the starting gate. The first USA Today survey since the two contenders effectively moved closer to their presidential nominations found a significant group of voters who were unhappy with their options and open to being persuaded, ingredients for a turbulent campaign. In what could be good news for Biden, an increasing number of Americans reported seeing green shoots in the economy. It's the rosiest economic assessment since the early days of his presidency. I think public awareness is starting to catch up with the reality that the economy is actually doing really, really well, said Craig Ritchie, 62, a composer in Los Angeles who was called in the poll. A Democrat, he said, the noise machine on the other side had drowned out Biden's phenomenal accomplishments in rebuilding a pandemic-wracked economy. But Nick Garcia, 40, a mechanic from Cadiz, Kentucky, who plans to vote for Trump, blamed Biden for the downturn that he sees. I think it's just struggling to hang on, he said of the economy in a follow-up phone interview. When Trump was in office, I was doing really good. The poll of 1,000 registered voters taken by landline and cell phone March 8th to 11th has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.1 percentage points. Nearly 8 months out, the election is not set. One in four of those surveyed said they might change their minds before November. That unsettled sentiment was bipartisan, including 14% of Biden voters and 15% of Trump voters. Most of those now backing a third-party candidate said they were open to changing their minds. Among them, 75% of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. supporters and 94% of Jill Stein supporters. That signals the potential erosion that independent candidates often see as Election Day nears. It also provides a big opportunity for each major party candidate to make his case to voters who are now reluctant or unwilling to support him, and to convince those voters that it would be dangerous or unwise to back the other guy. One key swing group has been dubbed the double haters, the 15% who dislike both Biden and Trump. In the survey, 25% of them supported Trump, 18% Biden, and 44% third-party candidates. Kennedy drew more of these voters, 21%, than Biden did. Jana Pender, 67, a retired casino housekeeper from Detroit, is a registered Democrat, but now considers herself an independent. She said neither party was doing enough to represent working people on the economy or address the humanitarian plight of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. She won't vote for Trump, and was 99% sure she won't support Biden. Voters ranked inflation and the economy as the most important issue determining their vote at 29%, with immigration 24% and threats to democracy 23% close behind. The only other issue that broke into double digits was abortion at 10%. views of the economy have rebounded to the most optimistic level since Biden moved into the White House. In the 10 national USA Today Suffolk polls since then, the percentage who said there was an economic recovery underway stood at 32% in the first one and steadily fell to a low of 9% in July 2022. Since then, it has steadily risen to 33% in the latest one. That could boost Biden, whose approval-disapproval rating was still decidedly tepid at 41 to 55%. Still, that did reflect an improvement since the previous USA Today Suffolk poll result of 39 to 58% in late December. Biden is now backed by 81% of his fellow Democrats, with the rest scattered among third-party candidates. 5% were undecided. Among Biden's supporters, 54% they were voting mostly for him. 41% were voting mostly against Trump. "The biggest thing for me is that he's not Trump," said Matt Williams, 30, a teacher from Sydney, New York, accusing the former president of trying to gut democracy. Still, Williams said he wasn't super stoked about Biden. "I wish we had other popular Democratic candidates who are younger," he said, mentioning California Representative Katie Porter and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. Trump faced some erosion within his party as well. 85% of Republicans were supporting him, with 6% backing Kennedy and 2% undecided. That said, his voters were significantly more positively committed to their candidate. 74% said they were voting mostly for him, 22% mostly against Biden. In fact, Trump's approval rating for the job he did as president was higher than when he was actually in office. Now 49% express approval, 47% disapproval. Both Democrats and Republicans seem prepared for a 2020 rematch. Among Democrats, 82% they said they would feel excited or satisfied by Biden's formal nomination at the convention, while 86% of Republicans said the same of Trump's nomination. Biden's State of the Union address last week had a mixed impact on the 56% of Americans who saw all or part of it. 33% said it made their view of Biden better, 28% worse. Looking ahead, 44% said they plan to follow Trump's hush money trial in New York, but the effect a conviction could have on their vote seemed small. Among Trump voters, 84% said they would still vote for him if he were convicted in this trial or others. "The indictments are make-believe," scoffed Richard Krasnodemski, 80, a retired auto worker from Allen Park, Michigan. Sarah Sarborny, a retired teacher, nurse from Cary, North Carolina, declared her support for Joseph Robinette Biden, using his full name and underscoring the high stakes in the election.
A Georgia judge dismisses some charges against Trump. The Georgia judge presiding over Donald Trump's case for allegedly trying to steal the 2020 election dismissed six charges Wednesday from the indictment for not being specific enough against the former president and a handful of his co-defendants. Fulton County Judge Scott McAfee dismissed charges alleging the co-defendants asked public officials to violate their oaths of office by switching presidential electors from those for President Joe Biden, who won the state, to Trump. McAfee ruled that the indictment failed to provide enough detail about the underlying felonies in the request that co-defendants were making in their meetings with lawmakers or calls to state officials. They do not give the defendants enough information to prepare their defendants intelligently, as the defendants could have violated the Constitution and thus the statute of dozens, if not hundreds, of distinct ways, McAfee ruled. But McAfee said the problem could be easily remedied. He left in place acts described in the indictment, such as Trump's call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, in which he asked Raffensperger to find the votes needed to hand him a victory in the state. McAfee said the acts could still be alleged as part of the conspiracy. He left in place 35 charges in the indictment. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis could potentially seek an updated indictment that is more detailed. Trump had 3 of the 13 charges against him dropped. The charges dealt with allegations he asked State House Speaker David Ralston and Raffensperger change the results of the election. Charges were also dropped against several Trump associates. This is a list of those charges against those associates. First, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had 1 of 2 charges against him dismissed for setting up Trump's call January 2, 2021 to Raffensperger, asking him to find enough votes for Trump to win the state. Meadows is still charged as part of the overall racketeering conspiracy. Next, Rudy Giuliani, who served as Trump's campaign lawyer, had 2 of 13 charges dropped dealing with hearings in December 2020, where he and others asked state lawmakers to switch presidential electors. Third, John Eastman, a lawyer who helped develop the proposal to switch electors, had 1 of 9 charges dropped for a meeting with state lawmakers. The next is Ray Smith, another lawyer. He had 2 of the 12 charges dropped dealing with meetings with lawmakers. And finally, Robert Cheely, another lawyer, had 1 of 10 charges dropped dealing with a meeting with lawmakers. Trump and 14 co-defendants are charged with a racketeering conspiracy that they tried to steal the 2020 election. 4 other co-defendants have pleaded guilty. McAfee has not yet scheduled the trial. He is also considering whether to disqualify Willis and Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade from the case.
Uvalde Police Chief announces resignation. The police chief in Uvalde, Texas, resigned Tuesday, less than a week after a city-commissioned report absolved department leadership and responding officers of wrongdoing in the 2022 mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Texas. Chief Daniel Rodriguez has led the department since 2018. He was out of town when a gunman on May 24, 2022, killed 19 children and 2 adults at Robb Elementary, and state and local law enforcement officers waited more than an hour to confront the shooter. Police spokesman Fernando Fernandez confirmed to the Austin American-Statesman on Tuesday that Rodriguez gave his resignation, which will go into effect April 6th. In a news release, Rodriguez did not explain his decision to leave his post, but he said he was proud of the positive impact we've made during my tenure, and that he was eager to explore new opportunities. The city commissioned report was conducted by former Austin police detective Jesse Prado, who in his findings suggested that no individual officer was responsible for the delayed intervention during the shooting. The report instead identified broader faults in law enforcement communication, a lack of access to the school site, poor police equipment, and poor SWAT training. At his council presentation last week, Prado said that police leadership and responding officers acted in good faith and that all had acted in accordance with policy and procedure. Prado's findings infuriated victims' families. It also spurred angry reactions from some council members, including Hector Luevano, who told Prado that he and community members were insulted by your comments. Brett Cross, who was the guardian for Uzziah Uzi Garcia, who died in the shooting, said in a video Tuesday on X that he was surprised by Rodriguez's announcements, but believes city leaders are not off the hook. Why? He's been there for 2 years almost since the accident, never stepped down, never walked away, even though his guys failed majorly. Why now? Cross asked. Why, after this report came out that exonerated all of them? Is it because they're to turn their backs on each other? Because I hope that's, and then he had an expletive, case. Prado's presentation ran counter to a report by the Justice Department, which found that a failure of leadership and officers' delay for 77 minutes to breach the classroom cost lives. The federal report specifically noted that lives would have been saved if police had broken into the classroom and killed the gunman. Uvalde Police Lieutenant Mariano Pargas, the city's police leader the day of the shooting, resigned in November 2022, shortly before Uvalde city leaders were expected to make a decision on his post. Assistant Chief Homer Delgado is expected to be the interim chief. He joined the city's force in May 2023.
And we'll wrap up. That wraps up the stories from the front page section of the Register. And we will wrap up this shift with some of the items from USA Today's 50 State Roundup. We'll start with the highlight, which comes from South Carolina in Greenville. And it has a picture here of goats behind a fence and a sign that says herd at work. In Greenville, South Carolina, goats are joining the city of Greenville's landscaping crew. Four herds of goats will be grazing in Greenville's Cleveland Park this month to help clear the Richland Creek bank of invasive plants by eating and digesting them. Goatscaping is an environmentally friendly way to maintain grounds. Instead of weed whacking or chemical sprays, goats graze on plants like kudzu and poison ivy to help clear the area. Greenville Parks and Grounds Administrator Stacy Schaefer said using goats helps keep the area tidy with a minimal carbon footprint. The goats are also cost effective, and they look pretty darn cute in this picture, too. Moving on then to Rushville, Illinois. Five people, including three young children, have died in a two-vehicle crash in Rushville. The accident involved a semi-truck and a school bus, according to local authorities. From Minneapolis, Minnesota. After an unusually warm winter in Minnesota, Lake Minnetonka was poised to break an over 100-year record for earliest ice out on the lake, but it fell short. The lake has not been declared ice-free yet, a climatologist said, and there was still ice on the lower lake as of Monday. From Lincoln, Nebraska, the Nebraska State Board of Education pushed back calls last week for a ban on sexually explicit and pornographic book material from all school libraries following a heated exchange in public testimony, including threats to flip tables. The 5-3 vote put an end to Aurora Board Member Kirk Penner's third attempt to get the motion passed. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a former child care worker charged with child pornography and sexual conduct with children in his care was sentenced to 25 years in prison at the Minnehaha County Courthouse. From Milwaukee, Wisconsin, last week, weather experts confirmed that many have been predicting for the past few weeks. This was, in fact, Wisconsin's warmest ever winter on record. The Wisconsin State Climatology Office announced that December of 2023 to February of 2024 was the warmest winter in the state since record keeping began in 1895. And finally in, I'm looking for Kansas here, Topeka, Kansas, as Republicans pursue legislation opposed to diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, Democrats question why, and a new report suggests there could be costly economic consequences. Much of the political focus in the Kansas legislature has been on restricting DEI statements in hiring practices, but there has also been action to cut university budgets because of DEI, and the confirmation of the Kansas Board of Regents chair was held up after his vocal support of DEI. And that brings us to the end of our shift. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. It has been our great pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Teresa Whitaker and Scott Splavik. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Scott with our next article.
Thank you, Teresa. I'll start with the Des Moines Register opinion page and the Your Turn, written by Randy Evans, guest columnist and a retired journalist, and it's entitled Trump Porter Both Wrong to Say Rigged Election. Like many people who call this state home, I have long taken an interest in the careers and achievements of people who have gotten their start in Iowa. As a kid, I was fascinated to walk through that two-room cottage in West Branch, knowing a president of the United States, Herbert Hoover, was born there. Having grown up at the start of the space age, I have marveled at the achievements of Peggy Whitson, whose record-breaking space career was launched in Beaconsfield and the public schools of Mount Air. And more recently, I have been amazed by the talents of Caitlin Clark, the University of Iowa basketball wizard who has drawn attention from fans around the globe. All of this may help explain why I have paid more than passing attention to Democrat Katie Porter, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from California, and why I was greatly disappointed by her outlandish, baseless comments after she lost the recent California primary election for an open U.S. Senate seat. Porter's roots run back to the soil of southern Iowa, a few counties west of where I came from. Now, age 50, she grew up on a farm outside of Creston during the farm crisis of the 1980s. Her father, Dan, was a farmer and banker. Her mother, Liz, is the Porter of Fonz and Porter's Love of Quilting magazine and public television fame. Katie Porter received her bachelor's degree from Yale University and her law degree from Harvard University. Before being elected to Congress in 2018, she interned for U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley and later taught law, including several years at the University of Iowa, before she moved on to the University of California, Irvine Law School. In Congress, the mother of three quickly developed a reputation as a member whose focus was on consumers and middle-class Americans, not the well-heeled interests of corporations and their executives. Using a whiteboard and marker to make her points or highlight evidence, she proved to be an aggressive, effective interrogator of government officials and corporate executives when they were called to testify at congressional hearings. Along the way, she also wrote a best-selling book called I Swear, Politics is Messier Than My Minivan. That van bears the license plate, Oversight. Porter has many fans. Actress Whoopi Goldberg wrote on the dust jacket of the book, "When Representative Katie Porter speaks, I know she knows what she's talking about and gives it to you straight up. It is because of Porter's reputation as a no-nonsense speaker that I was especially disappointed by her comments following her loss to another California Democrat, Adam Schiff, in the March 5th primary election. Porter spouted off following her loss, sounding too much like a former president. She said billionaires had rigged the election in Schiff's favor through what she called dishonest means, a reference to ads critical of her that were paid for by interest groups favoring Schiff. Porter could have thanked voters who supported her. She could have expressed her appreciation to voters in her House district who had chosen her to represent them for the past 6 years. She could have congratulated Schiff and wished him well in the November election when he faces Republican Steve Garvey, a former Major League Baseball player. She could have accepted her defeat with grace and gone home to rest and reflect on what she wants to do in the next chapter of her life. You can dislike the campaign finance laws, as Porter does. You can believe political groups have outsized voices because of their ability to spend staggering amounts of so-called dark money, as Porter does. And you can believe you would have been a better senator than Schiff, as Porter surely does. But using words like rigged and dishonest is wrong in so many ways, as anyone who has been listening for the past 4 years understands. A Harvard-educated lawyer with Southern Iowa common sense should understand that. Porter should realize her rash comments made without evidence only help to further undermine public confidence in our election system. The comments have seriously eroded her reputation as an important voice in American politics and have added to the unhealthy rhetoric that saturates our nation. Her angry words are all too reminiscent of the comments by people like Donald Trump, Arizona's Carrie Lake, and Eldridge, Iowa native, by the way, MyPillow founder Mike Lindell, and other Republicans who continue to make fact-free claims that Trump defeated Joe Biden in 2020. Steve Shale, a longtime Democrat strategist in Florida, told PolitiFact, a political news and fact-checking website, "There is nothing more important to our democracy than people acknowledging they lose elections." Michael Thorning of the Bipartisan Policy Center, a nonprofit organization, wrote on the social media site formerly known as Twitter that Porter's comments were completely irresponsible and unserious. Too often, we Americans are quick to point out the flaws and mistakes by politicians we oppose, but are too blind to similar flaws and mistakes by politicians we support. Katie Porter's embarrassing display after this month's election should not be defended by her fellow Democrats any more than Trump's post-election nonsense should be defended by his fellow Republicans. Irresponsible is still irresponsible, regardless of the party affiliation or the person making such wild accusations. And again, that was written by retired journalist Randy Evans.
Okay, and I'm going to go to the next guest column. This is by Kelsey Patrick Faree and Shannon Patrick. Uncontested seats help foster fear, demonizing of political opponents. In our most recent column, we asked, why are Republican policies so bad for rural Iowa? We suggested one possible answer: Republicans aren't really a rural party. We thought the column was more analytic than electrifying, so we were surprised when we received a caustic comment claiming that Democrats are all contemptible, corrupt, narcissistic buffoons and a stain on humanity. And that over-the-top reaction to party registration statistics prompts another question: why do so many voters so strongly support a party, even when that party might not support them? Many people vote for their team, regardless of what policies either party proposes. But why does that happen? One explanation could be that they are captive voters. Captive voters are voters with no real choice in what party they support. The term originally referred to black voters. Republicans, the story went, opposed the Voting Rights Act, affirmative action, and similar policies, leaving black voters with no viable alternative to the Democratic Party. So the Democratic Party would mostly ignore their other policy preferences. This concept applies to rural Iowans very literally. In 2022, 45 Iowa legislative seats were uncontested. Often, rural seats had no Democratic challenger, and urban seats had no Republican challenger. And no challenger also means no debate, no discussion, no local face to give the lie to whatever caricature the unopposed party paints about the other side. And that creates the conditions for a second explanation. Parties can capture their voters' minds, not just their votes. They do this through propaganda, exaggerations, and lies, dehumanization of outgroups, and peer pressure. The goal is to move people from agreeing with certain things a political party stands for to becoming tools of the party. Parties stop pitching their own visions of the future and instead preach fear about the depraved, blighted hellscape that they say the other party will bring about. These techniques were broadly studied in the aftermath of the Holocaust, World War II, and the authoritarianism and totalitarianism of the 1930s and 1940s. We can hear them repeating today in talk radio, Russian propaganda, and Donald Trump's Hitleresque language. These tactics succeed more easily when no one local is standing up to argue against them. Captive minds and captive voters combined lead to negative partisanship. Negative partisanship means voting against one party, not for the other party. It's on the rise, and it affects supporters of both parties and independents alike. In the face of this division and negativity, we find ourselves returning to Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny and the essay that led to its creation. When listening to politicians, distinguish certain words. Look out for the expansive use of terrorism and extremism. Be alive to the fatal notions of exception and emergency. Be angry about the treacherous use of patriotic vocabulary. The last part is especially important. We should not just accept the terms politicians and pundits use. We should get angry at them for demonizing our neighbors, relatives, and fellow Americans, not at the people they are targeting. With some unfortunate exceptions, most of your fellow citizens may have different priorities or different experiences, but they do not want to destroy America. Think hard before believing anyone who says otherwise. Captive voters and captive minds are bad for democracy, and they are also bad for uncontested Iowa, urban and rural alike. Fortunately, we can take concrete actions to fix this. We can demand that our representatives appear at forums and debates where the public can hear them. We can press them to present us with a vision of what they are for, not just what they oppose, and call them out if they fall to slandering their opponents. We can encourage our elected officials to adopt systems like ranked choice voting that reduce negative partisanship. And if we find ourselves apoplectic over voter registration statistics, we should consider who benefits from our anger. And that again was from Kelsey Patrick Faree and Shannon Patrick, who live in Iowa City.
I guess we'll switch over to sports and go over what's on TV today. And if you're a men's college basketball fan, you're in for a treat. There is a number of games on today. Starting at 10:30 a.m. on the USA Network, it's the AC Atlantic 10 tournament, St. Joseph's versus Richmond. 11 a.m. on the Big Ten Network, it's Minnesota versus Michigan State. On ESPN in the Atlantic Coast Tournament, it's Florida State versus North Carolina. And on FS1, it's the Big East Tournament, Xavier Butler winner versus UConn. 11:30 a.m., ESPN2 has the Big 12 Tournament, BYU versus Texas Tech. ESPNU has the American Athletic Tournament, Tulsa versus East Carolina. Noon on the SEC Network has the Southeastern Tournament, Mississippi State versus LSU. 1 p.m. on the USA Network in the Atlantic 10 tournament. It's VCU versus UMass. 1:30 p.m. on the Big Ten Network. It's the Big Ten tournament, Rutgers-Maryland game. Rutgers-Maryland winner, though, so the winner of that game versus Wisconsin. On ESPN2 in the Atlantic Coast Tournament, it's Wake Forest versus Pittsburgh. And on FS1 in the Big East Tournament, it's St. John's versus Seton Hall. 2 p.m., CBSN has the Mountain West Tournament, Fresno State versus Utah State. ESPN has the Big 12 Tournament, the winner of Oklahoma-TCU versus Houston. ESPNU has the American Athletic Tournament, Wichita State versus Memphis. And the Pac-12 Network has the Pac-12 Tournament, Southern Cal versus Arizona. 2:30 p.m. on the SEC Network, it's the Southeastern Tournament, Vanderbilt, Arkansas winner versus South Carolina. 4 p.m. on USA, it's Atlantic 10 Tournament, LaSalle, St. Bonaventure winner versus Loyola Chicago. 4:30 p.m. on the CBS Sports Network, it's Mountain West Tournament, UNLV versus San Diego State. On the Pac-12 Network, it's the Pac-12 Tournament game, UCLA, Oregon State winner versus Oregon. At 5:30 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, it's the Big Ten Tournament game, Ohio State versus Iowa. 6 p.m. on ESPN in the Atlantic Coast Tournament, it's North Carolina State, Syracuse winner versus Duke. ESPN2 Big 12 Tournament, Kansas State, Texas winner versus Iowa State, and I believe it's Kansas State that Iowa State will be playing at 6 p.m. on ESPN2. ESPNU has the American Athletic Tournament, Tulane versus North Texas. FS1 in the Big East Tournament, it's Georgetown-Providence winner versus Creighton. And SEC has the Southeastern Tournament, Mississippi versus Texas A&M. 6:30 p.m. USA, Atlantic 10 Tournament, Duquesne-St. Louis winner versus Dayton. 8 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, the Big Ten Tournament game of the Michigan-Penn State winner versus Indiana. CBS Sports Network, Mountain West Tournament, Colorado State-San Jose State winner versus Nevada. And the Pac-12 Network, Pac-12 Tournament, California-Stanford winner versus Washington State. 8:30 p.m., ESPN in the Atlantic Coast Tournament. It's Boston College Clemson winner versus Virginia. ESPN2 in the Big 12 Tournament is the Cincinnati Kansas winner versus Baylor. ESPNU, the American Athletic Tournament, has UTSA Temple winner versus SMU. FS1 in the Big East Tournament, DePaul Villanova winner versus Marquette. And the SEC Network, the Southeastern Tournament, the Missouri-Georgia winner versus Florida. And finally, at 10:30 p.m. on CBS Sports Network in the Mountain West Tournament, it's the New Mexico Air Force winner versus Boise State. And on FS1 in the Pac-12 Tournament, the Utah-Arizona State winner versus Colorado. Women's college basketball, 4 p.m. on ESPNU in the Southland Tournament. The teams are to be determined, and looks like that's the championship game for that tournament. And that is it for college basketball. NBA basketball, 6:30 p.m. on TNT, Phoenix at Boston, and 9 p.m. on TNT and on True TV, it's Dallas at Oklahoma City.
Hey, I'm going to read an article here about college wrestling. The NCAA qualifiers from Iowa, Iowa State, and UNI. The NCAA on Tuesday released the at-large qualifiers for the NCAA Wrestling Championships, completing the field of 330 wrestlers for next week's Division I tournament in Kansas City. Iowa, Iowa State, and Northern Iowa had a combined 22 wrestlers qualify at last weekend's conference tournaments. Three more earned at-large bids. Iowa will send 9 wrestlers to the NCAAs, all of whom were automatic qualifiers based on their performances at the Big Ten Championships. Hawkeyes 184-pound freshman Aiden Riggins missed the cut. He finishes the season 14-14. Iowa State will also send 9, having 8 automatic qualifiers and 1 at-large qualifier in 184-pound senior Will Feldkamp. This is the most NCAA qualifiers the Cyclones have had since the 2022 NCAA Championships, when they also sent nine. 197-pound senior Julian Broderson was the odd man out for Iowa State, preventing the Cyclones from having 10 qualifiers for the first time since 2010. Northern Iowa secured five automatic qualifiers and two at-large bids in Julian Farber at 133 pounds and Jared Sima at 174 pounds. Of the Panthers, seven qualifiers, five are first-time NCAA qualifiers. Brackets for the NCAA championships will be released Wednesday at 8 p.m. on NCAA.com. Here are all the NCAA qualifiers for the State of Iowa programs. We have, this is Iowa's wrestling team's qualifiers. At 125 pounds, Drake Ayala. At 133 pounds, Brody Teske. At 141 pounds, Rhea Woods. At 149 pounds, Caleb Rathjen. 157 pounds is Jerob Franick. 165 pounds, Michael Caliendo. At 174 pounds, Patrick Kennedy. 197 pounds, Zach Glazier. At 285 pounds, Bradley Hill. Iowa State's qualifiers, at 125 pounds, Kyson Tarukina. At 133 pounds, Evan Frost. At 141 pounds, Anthony Ekamendia. At 149 pounds, Casey Swiderski. At 157 pounds, Cody Chittum. 165 pounds is David Carr. 174 pounds, MJ Gayton. At 184 pounds, Will Feldkamp. And at 285 pounds, Younger Bastida. Northern Iowa's qualifiers, at 133 pounds, Julian Farber. 141 pounds, Cale Heppel. 157 pounds, Ryder Downey. 165 pounds, Jack Thompson. At 174 pounds, Jared Sima. At 184 pounds, Parker Kekison. And at 197 pounds, Wyatt Volker.
And quickly here, ISU loses to Texas in Big 12 tourney title game. The Iowa State women's basketball team's surprisingly successful season took another unexpected turn when the Cyclones arrived at the Big 12 tournament. After beating Baylor, the Cyclones stunned top-seeded Oklahoma and stormed into the championship game for the second straight season. But Iowa State's magical run came to an end Tuesday night. Number 2 seed Texas ended the surprise story by beating the Cyclones 70-53 in the Big 12 tournament title game at the T-Mobile Center. Iowa State, the tournament's reigning champion, had its six-game winning streak come to an end and fell to 20 wins and 10 losses. "We did, for the most part, what we came here to do this week," said Iowa State freshman Audie Crooks. "We played two really good games and a really good half, I'd say, in this game." After losing to Iowa State in last season's title game, Texas got its revenge by beating the Cyclones in dominating fashion in the regular season and again in Tuesday's championship game. The Longhorns, the top offensive team in the Big 12 this season, shot 46% from the field, including 64% from three-point range. Their offensive onslaught started right away during a strong first quarter that included a 7-0 run to take a quick 14-4 lead. Crooks, Iowa State's top scoring threat, missed her first five shots of the game and scored the Cyclones' first basket of the quarter with 5 minutes and 30 seconds remaining. By then, the damage was done. Even after a three-pointer by Kelsey Jones late in the second quarter, the Cyclones hobbled into halftime, trailing 40-21. But the young Cyclones, as they have so often this season, continued to battle the Longhorns and made Texas work for its win with an improved second half. Crooks, who tallied just 6 points in the first half, tallied two quick layups in the third quarter and brought Iowa State to within 40-25. Cyclones continued to cut into the lead with a 7-0 run on layups by Ryan and Crooks. A three-pointer by Ryan cut Texas's lead to 47-32. Ariana Jackson brought Iowa State to within 49-37 with a minute 21 left in the frame. Cyclones had a chance to cut the lead to single digits, but their following possession came up empty. Crooks, despite the first half struggles, finished with 25 points and 10 rebounds. She was the only Cyclone to score in double figures. Ryan finished with 7 points, 8 assists, and 4 rebounds. "We've got a lot of work to do and a lot of learning to do, and we still have the postseason." Cyclones 31st in the net rankings entering Tuesday will find out their NCAA tournament seed and opponent on Sunday at 7 p.m. on ESPN.
Okay, we're going to turn to Dear Abby. X fails to show at family funeral. Dear Abby, my mom passed away recently, and the person I was in a relationship with from adolescence to my adulthood, Charles, didn't attend her funeral. While I'm currently in a relationship with someone else I deeply love, I still feel my mother was fond of Charles despite our many hardships. Her affection for him showed without a doubt, many times without my involvement. Despite my resentment towards Charles, it never swayed her opinion of him. I no longer speak to Charles. This pattern was well set before Mom's death. Because she cared for him, I think it was wrong of him not to show up to pay his respects, regardless of what our situation currently is. For the record, I didn't attend either of his parents' funerals because Charles liked to gaslight and cause drama. Now that I'm no longer a teenager, I see him for who he really is. I thought I was in love at the time, but I realize now that I was still in the age of innocence. While I no longer want him in my space or life, I still feel his not attending was selfish and pathetic. Are my feelings valid? Mourning in Missouri. And Abby says, Dear Mourning, please accept my sympathy for the loss of your dear mother. That said, the time has come to let go of your relationship with Charles. You wrote that you no longer want him in your life, yet you cling to your resentment of him. Funerals are for the living. The deceased are past the point of knowing if someone attends or not. Charles may have stayed away because he knows you dislike him and felt unwelcome. Scrub him out of your head and stop living in the past. As the late Elie Wiesel once pointed out, the opposite of love isn't hate, it is indifference. And our next letter to Dear Abby, my girlfriend's 36-year-old son refuses to work. He has every excuse in the book. No job is just right for him. Without any education or training, he expects to make $20 per hour. Even then, he either quits or gets fired. He has lived off family for all of the 5 years I have known him. He couldn't find a job, even part-time last year, and never paid rent. We were forced to move. Now we are in a 55-plus community that does not allow children, and her son is hiding in the living room and porch. He has created a cell for himself. If discovered, the community can evict us. How do we get him out? Prison, that's from Prison for All in Florida. Dear Prison for All, the son is 36 and hiding in a cell he has created for himself? Is he mentally disabled? Taking drugs? After 5 years, it's time you and your girlfriend formed a united front and gave her son a deadline by which to find a job and move. After that deadline, he can couch surf with friends if necessary. Then cross your fingers and pray the management of the community in which you live doesn't catch on to what's been going on, or you and your girlfriend may be looking for another home as well. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Scott Splavik. Earlier, you heard from Linda Lundgren and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.